Hello and welcome to the Young Fabians podcast. This week we are going to be discussing policing in the UK based on the Black Lives Matter protests that we have seen in the last few weeks. We have been having quite a few conversations about racial inequalities in the UK stemming from the murder of George Floyd in the US. It'll come to 5 weeks ago now. It has sparked a global conversation about racial inequalities, about inequalities in general, especially in the US, but I think the UK being culturally close to the US has sort of meant that we have been analysing our own behaviour and past behaviour as well, and our own institutional racism. So this week we're going to be doing a little bit of a 101 of law enforcement and policing in the UK. With us we have Amavir, Milad and James, who will introduce themselves, who are from the Economy and Finance, the Law and Local Government and Devolution Network. Amavir, I'll start with you. Please introduce yourselves a little bit.
Thanks for inviting me, Carolina. My name is Amavir and I'm the Secretary of the Economy and Finance Network. In my day job, I work as an economist. During my time at Durham University, I've published one article on racial inequality in the UK, and I have also set up a decolonisation scholarship in the School of Government.
I'm Milad. I'm the Secretary to the Young Fabians Law Network. In my day job, I work for a Labour Member of Parliament as a caseworker. And I actually come to this discussion with quite a lot of interest in the policing. I actually served as in a very junior rank as a voluntary police officer for quite some time, actually, for 6 years in the Metropolitan Police. So I come to the conversation tonight with a huge passion for policing and how we can make it work, really, for society and how we can all contribute to it. So it's a hot topic and glad to be on tonight.
And yes, so hi, my name's James Potts. I am the chair of the Young Fabians Devolution and Local Government Network. And in my day job, I sort of work in regional government, working at London City Hall, where the mayor has responsibility for the Metropolitan Police and sort of oversight and responsibility of that. So although it's not directly in my day job, it is indirectly in my day job.
Fantastic. Thank you. I'll jump straight in, James. You did an event for the Young Fabians with Sarah Jones MP, who was Shadow Minister for Community Policing, is it?
Police and fire is the two areas. So, yeah, so all the police force and then all of the fire brigade, yeah.
So give us a little bit of extremely high level for somebody that may come into the podcast not really knowing how the police functions, how law enforcement functions in the UK.
So the top level, so the police force in this country and the police, I don't know, sort of law enforcement, if you want to use that umbrella term. Sort of modern policing goes back to the 1820s. Let's take you back in time, listeners, to the 1820s, where Sir Robert Peel, who was the Home Secretary and later Prime Minister, in 1929, he established the Metropolitan Police through the Metropolitan Police Act, which was the first full-time professional police force in the country. And Glasgow had the first sort of police, first professional police, but this was the first like full-time professional one for sort of a major city like London. Previously, it had been local communities like watchmen and constables, but it was the 1820s where this really started to get moving. And it's sort of the principles that Peel introduced are kind of at the heart of law enforcement in this country. And they're still kind of at the forefront of it today, which sort of testament to their longevity and their impact. And that sort of can be broken down into kind of three areas. The first one is to have ID numbers. And, you know, so in every individual officer has a way of identification. So they would have like a warrant. They would have a warrant thing and they would have a ID number, primarily an ID number, just to identify who they were. Second principle was that the effectiveness of their work would to be measured on the lack of crime, not the number of arrests. So obviously, if there's no crime, then you're doing a good job. Regardless, you know, it's no good arresting 200 people if there's still a lot of crime out there. So it was effectiveness measured on the lack of crime. And then thirdly, it was about trust and accountability. And there's a quote Peel mentioned, which was quite famous, which was the police are the public and the public are the police. And that is at the heart of this. And I think we can distill all of that down into three words, which is policing by consent, which is the big thing in this country. And, you know, we can look at our international neighbours and we can look at America. There is a different principle that underpins how they police and how they govern their population. And so, yeah, so the Peelian principles is kind of what they're known, policing by consent, this kind of we're part of the community, we're like you, there's this, you know, we're the same, is kind of at the heart of this. But how do they look at the moment? Well, there are 45 up and down the country. They are the kind of the territorial police forces as we know them. So that could be the Metropolitan Police in London, West Midlands Police in Birmingham and the Black Country, you know, sort of Mercia Police, you know, Thames Valley Police, etc. That, you know, they're based geographically, usually along county lines, in terms of the old way of saying that, rather than the more modern term for that time. But they're kind of based primarily on counties. And there has been kind of a push to merge those into smaller numbers, so potentially having regional ones. And there was a big push in the mid-noughties when Labour were in power to kind of merge them into regional forces, but that failed. There wasn't enough sort of consensus, and it never happened. But interestingly, it did happen in Scotland in 2013. So Scotland used to have 8 police forces, again sort of based on the counties up there, and they were merged in 2013 to be Police Scotland. And then in London, more recently in the last few years, each borough used to have its own police force. But again, they've sort of been these borough mergers where, you know, sort of 2 or 3 might be joined up sort of in a similar way. Like I work at City Hall with like the Assembly constituencies, not entirely the same, but some of them have been sort of merged in that way. So, yeah. And so obviously that's a kind of the organisations. And if you break that down, there's kind of 4 different kind of key roles that are on the kind of front line in the police. So you obviously have your beat officers, so your police constables who go around and sort of the sort of day-to-day policing. You have your community liaison police officers, obviously more famously known as PCSOs, police community support officers. They were introduced by Labour in the early noughties. And then you have the kind of the investigative level, so obviously your detectives and your kind of the more serious crime units who will go around and do that. And finally, you have like your specialists. So you'll have like your traffic police, your firearms units, your horse police, your marine police, if you have that. Which one?
The horse police. I was thinking like both the detectives and the horse police. Everyone's like, yeah, that's the cool job.
Equine might be a better word, I think. But yeah, I've got horse written down on the notes I made earlier, so that's my fault. But so you have your specialist teams as well who will deal with different situations. And how is all of this overseen and accountable? That was changed in the coalition in 2012. We started to elect police and crime commissioners who are directly elected by the people every 4 years. And they are there to oversee each police force and make sure that they are keeping everything to the letter of the law, if we're going to throw in a line of duty reference. So yeah, that's kind of a rough, very sketchy, very top level, very basic overview of how the police is in the UK at the moment.
James, thank you for that. That was a really wonderful kind of overview. I think that clarifies a lot. Now, when we talk about inequalities within the system, we know that there's huge issues in the criminal justice system. So once people have been arrested, have been convicted, people from BME backgrounds stay longer in prison, they have tougher sentences, they're less well represented. So we know that there's all these problems, but a lot of this starts with policing. So Milad, I was hoping that you would give us a bit of a sense of where the data shows that these inequalities are stemming from. Are police officers just arresting more people? Do we think that there's racial biases against them? Do we think that some BME communities are, you know, doing more crimes and therefore deserve to be to be arrested more?
Yeah, so I think it's a really valid question. Some of the statistics, when we look at them, I mean, yeah, the results aren't good. There seems to be much more representation amongst those that are stopped and searched and arrested in comparison to the population of those communities within the UK, or especially in urban areas. Now, I think with anything with policing, there's never any problems about asking questions, that the police are accountable to the public. You know, as James quite rightly pointed out, you know, one of the main principles of policing is that the police is not supposed to be an occupying force. The police are basically citizens in uniform. They're the same public in uniform. They just receive a full-time salary for doing that job, essentially. So there's no problems with questioning the police whatsoever. And there's actually very good processes in place to facilitate that. Now, every police officer that trains as a police officer and is attested and sworn in swears to be impartial. One of the things that I think history has taught us, I think certainly after the 50s, we've seen quite a lot of problems with the relationship between the police and ethnic minorities. And that's been an ongoing thing. In theory, in accordance to everything that we've got in place, there shouldn't be any bias. But I feel like one of the biggest things that a lot of reports have produced, say, for example, the McPherson report, the Lammy review, all of those sort of stuff, is we've got to be really careful in case there is some unconscious bias. So not bias that, you know, an officer begins their day to say, right, well, I'm gonna do something which might discriminate against someone, but something which they might not even be aware of. And part of that is to do with training. So, for example, with stop and search, it's a hugely, it's one of the most contentious issues in British policing, actually. In theory, it's supposed to be objective. If you follow it by the step of the rules that's been set up, your grounds for a stop and search should be objective. It should not relate to the characteristics of that person whatsoever. It's to do with the situational scenario that leads you to believe that something's happening for which warrants you to search for, I don't know, stolen property, drugs, or articles to be committed in a crime. I think actually in one of the other conversations that we had on this, on the Young Fabians, is that stop and search is quite an effective policing tool, but not on its own. So it's not a means to an end on its by itself. And if it's exercised in a way which is not monitored, it can sometimes be unproductive, because what you do is you might sort of search, I don't know, 20 people, and you'll find one weapon or one sort of item that you were looking for, like a drug or something like that. But then you've alienated 19 of those other people, yeah, because they feel they've been targeted. And that's where the problem comes in that if we're getting that disparity, what questions are we asking about why that stop and search took place and why the result wasn't achieved? Is there something that we're missing there? Are we getting something wrong for this to happen? So, and I don't mean to say that individual officers on the street should sort of face criticism at times, because, you know, they might just be following the rules that have been set up for them to implement. So we've got to question it a little bit higher up the line. But we've got to question the sort of, we've got to work with communities to see how they feel after stop and searches. I remember I was stopped once when I was about 13, and I came back home and I thought, well, what did I do? But, you know, the police officer was very polite, you know, no problems on the front. But when I came home and I told my mum and I showed her that piece of paper, she went into absolute panic. I mean, she thought, I've been out there doing God knows what. And I never forgot that. And in my time, I only made sure that if I ever had to search someone, it was for the right reasons. There was very, very good, strong ground. And accountability, I mean, the bar that accountability that needs to be set is almost, can you justify your actions in front of the court or in front of senior officers? And if that's the case, and you can justify it, and it's legal, it's proportionate, it's objective, then that's fine. And we've got to support the police when they get it right. But we can't rely on stop and search as a tool on its own. We've got to invest in a lot more in policing.
As an example, I've got some figures from last year that show that only 7% of stop and search actually led to an arrest, which is very low.
Yeah, the stop and search thing is, it seems like it's giving glimpse into a wider systemic problem within the police force, where, for instance, in Dorset, where per 1,000 of the population, 108 individuals have been stopped and searched in 2017, compared to only 9 that are white. So having a percentage difference of those is a 1,100% increase compared to black and white. Again, with Cumbria, it's a 643% difference. North Wales, Cheshire, as I showed Carolina yesterday, the number of stop and searches that have been related to black people are far, far higher than those that are white. So it seems like this is a glimpse into a larger systemic problem. And coming from Stoke-on-Trent, West Midlands, going to University of the North East, living in Southwark, I've been stopped and searched many times as well. So I actually relate to these figures. So it seems like it's a glimpse of a wider systemic problem.
It's worth mentioning that in the UK, actual deaths of civilians by the police are very, very low. I believe it's something like 3 in the last year. It's very, very small, and definitely. So this is by gunshots. Now we get into the matter of deaths in police custody and treatment of civilians in police custody, especially of BME communities. Milad, I don't know if you have any kind of like information on this, or a little bit of a glimpse of like how that process actually works. Where in the chain can people who have been arrested or that are waiting for trial be mistreated? How does that happen? I mean, you don't have a why, but why do you think that may be happening?
So if I can just, before I come on to that point, I'll just rewind back into history a little bit. One of the main reasons why the police force was set up was because of the disproportionate use of force, which was used by, sometimes it was the armed forces, really, that, you know, when there was a sort of disorder, you would essentially get like a magistrate turn up, read the riot act, as it was called, and protesters or whoever was creating the disorder had 1 hour to disperse. Otherwise, you know, any level of force could be used. And if members of the public joined in and assisted, there would be no sort of prosecution against them if incidents happened. So I think that whole proportionality has been very important aspects of British policing. And from the moment that you're arrested, you are in custody. I mean, essentially, you are that police officer. You are the police's responsibility. And there is a very sort of well-documented chain of responsibility. Once you're arrested, you know, you're brought into custody. You are then booked in. Your detention is authorised by a custody sergeant. And at that point, the responsibility then rests with the custody sergeant. So God forbid, if something was to happen, then obviously there would be full accountability. But I think one of the biggest problems has been transparency in policing. I think when incidents happen, they need to be investigated fully and properly. And it's only right, really, if there is a death in custody, you know, the family deserve to know what happened, fully deserve to know what happened. And, you know, we've moved towards an era of policing where we've got cameras now in police stations, everything's recorded. And quite importantly, we've got custody visitors now. So these are sort of groups of people that are able to visit custody suites at any time that they wish in order to make sure everything's okay, and to make sure that prisoners are doing fine. If they need anything, if they feel that they've been mistreated, they've got someone to talk to. Now, I can't give you a reason as to why incidents occur, because each one is unique in their own right. But I think what the public expect is to have full and transparent processes to deal with those incidents should they occur. And I think, you know, if there are cases of deaths in police custody, then that would be something that the Independent Office of Police Conduct would automatically be called in to investigate independently. So I think force has to be used proportionately. Sometimes custody suites are not the best place for people. You know, sometimes people that are suffering from mental health, for example, they need to be in a secure mental unit rather than a police custody suite, because that's not the environment that they need to be in. So I think it forms part of a wider range of things about how we hold our police to account and how we support prisoners as they come in and assess their needs, you know, and that's part of the determination that the custody sergeant needs to make when someone comes in.
One of the things that has been very much in the fray, and we will get onto the more polemic stuff a little bit later, but it's all about the funding of policing. So we know that funding has been cut severely for the last 10 years or so. We have seen about 9 years of declining numbers of police officers. They've risen slightly in the last couple of years, but there was a sort of 8-year decline. And we know specifically, for example, the community support officers' numbers have declined 5%, for example, just in the past year. And we know Corbyn, for example, called for about 10,000 more police to be hired. We have a very natural association between more police leading to less crime. We know that there's been cuts in funding in the UK and crime rates have gone up in the last 10 years. So I kind of want to put it to you guys a little bit. The recent BLM protests seem to try to break with that a little bit, that actually policing isn't the answer.
I think it's quite a difficult one to correlate the two, really, because with the reduction of policing and resources towards policing, the police has had less opportunity to engage in community policing, to engage in policing which is designed to support people. And what that tends to then lead to is you end up having a confrontational relationship with the police sometimes, whereby you're having to arrest someone, but actually a lot of crimes that people are arrested for, if there was early intervention in the community, those crimes wouldn't be happening in the first place. So the two things aren't, I mean, they're sort of linked, but not to a lot of extent. And, you know, one of the things that we've lost through cuts and austerity is that early engagement with people. So, for example, police officers in schools, where they build an early relationship with children, and children then sort of learn to trust that police officer and engage with that police officer, and that develops into the rest of their lives. We've lost a lot of that. We've sold our police stations. We've taken away that element of friendly policing with the public. And as a result of that, you know, we've put police officers in centralised police stations or in police cars. So the only time that you're being exposed to the police is when they either respond to you to an emergency or, for example, say they're stopping your car or something like that. So we've created a different style of policing simply by reducing the funding made towards the police.
So on the one hand, crime data, historical crime data over the past 10 years shows that crime has actually gone down. But crimes related to assault with injury and assault with intent to cause serious harm and robbery has gone up. Going back to Milad's point, it's hard to see that there's a causal aspect to any one of the two. The main thing when it comes to perhaps inequality of those that ethnic inequality of those commit crime is going to be just embedded in larger systemic issues about pupil exclusions of those young children, young people at an early age, feeling of belonging, intent to vote, whether they also, the ONS releases statistics on how often people chat to their neighbours. And again, Black people chat to their neighbours the least, feeling of belonging. Now, these are the wider systemic issues which are still perhaps show that Black have the least confidence with the police. It could even be myself when I was going for a run today along the canal, seeing the police car in Stoke-on-Trent. It may lead to one thing, perhaps it's just absolutely fine. So it'll be wrong for anyone to say that this obviously leads to this, because on the one hand, overall crime rates have gone down, but then there's a question of, well, other areas of crime have actually gone up. Issues being, A, what counts as crime within the ONS statistics. You know, the Conservative government may have shifted the definition so that it seems that they're actually reducing crime. That used to be New Labour's trick, recategorising how things are defined, so it seems that they're better. But there's still one systemic issue which remains, that Black people, regardless of how much funding there is in crime, they're still going to be the ones that are victimised most.
Yeah, so I just want to kind of like build on that and just sort of say that, yeah, I mean, obviously, Amavi, you're 100% right. So, the general level of crime has dropped, but serious and violent crime in particular has gone up recently in the last few years. It's interesting because this is kind of linked to, I think Milad was also hinting at this, as sort of like the community policing is obviously key in sort of prevention and early intervention. I used to work for Graham Allen, who was sort of early intervention in sort of like all everything he kind of did and said was about early intervention. Those principles also apply here to policing. So it's not just policing that has been cut. There are, you know, cuts to other parts of society that have obviously impacted on policing. And for me, a big one that absolutely needs mentioning is youth services. In London in the last decade, £132 million a year has been cut off youth services, and that's 60% of the budget. And that's everything. So that's stuff like youth clubs, et cetera, all that youth provision that does a lot of good work in sort of doing that prevention and that early intervention and sort of keeping kids out of trouble, if you want to use a slightly old fashioned phrase. But it's 100% relevant today in terms of, you know, it's important to have that. So the cuts to youth services, you know, you keep people out of crime, you give them those opportunities to try and better themselves. And without that, say you're you know, a vulnerable teenager who potentially slip into a life of crime, and rather than, you know, going to your youth club every night, you misbehave and you get excluded from school for a week. And your kind of your motivation then dips massively and you think, well, what's the point of this? And, you know, next thing you know, you are looking at those more attractive, you know, those, oh, that life of crime seems attractive if normal society doesn't want me to, you know, sort of succeed and have those opportunities. So I think it's worth bearing in mind that, again, there's the more kind of, you know, I think Amavi was talking about the systemic issues here, like, and Milad was touching on it as well. But yeah, like youth services in particular would have had an increase in sort of, you know, it's again, who is committing the violent crime? Is it you know, gangs, etc.? And again, that is kind of the pathway to it.
It's worth mentioning that the person who committed the stabbings in Reading, fatal stabbings in Reading a couple of weeks ago, has been arrested and is a 21-year-old man. boy. I would like to read more about the circumstances of him getting to that point. But it's tragic. It's tragic for everyone. It's tragic for the people who have died, who suffered, who had to watch it. And it's tragic for the guy himself.
I think just picking up on that, really, one of the two things that's really important is the police has a really important safeguarding function. So we want people to go to the police. We want public cooperation. If people want help, we want them to approach the authorities. But what they need is confidence in the process. And what the cuts have really showed us is the more that the services are being cut, the less the police is able to respond to things, investigate things, and help on matters. So if, for example, the government turns out and says, well, crime against property has dropped. Well, I would dispute that, because sometimes certain crimes aren't being reported anymore by the police because they just haven't got the resources. They've just had to say, sorry, we're going to stop reporting this. And once that happens, people lose confidence in the process and they don't report things to the police. And we want people to report things to the police. We want people, if something's not quite right, we want them to let the police know. And sometimes, you know, we talked about this incident in Reading. I mean, that's just one example. We want people to, if they spot something they're not quite happy about something, maybe someone's been being groomed in the early stages of being groomed, we want them to approach the police for early intervention. And unless we can resource the police properly to deal with each of those cases as sympathetically and properly as possible, a lot of communities are going to lose confidence in the police service as a whole. So again, a lot of it comes down to money. And the less that we fund our police, the less we can get out of it, the less social goods we can get out of it.
Yeah, speaking, going on to your point, Milad, and confidence in the police is essential in order to deal with a large swathe of things related to crime. People from Black mixed ethnic backgrounds are less likely than whites and Asian people to have confidence in their local police. And every year covered by this data, Black Caribbean people especially were less likely than white people to have confidence in their local police. Janet Davey yesterday, MP for Lewisham East, she mentioned the House of Commons. Why is there only 1% of full-time police officers in 2019 that were Black? And why has this not improved since the Lammy Review? And it seems that when you have this institution which is funded by ourselves, the taxpayers, which fund this body of people which don't look like them, don't relate to them, are more likely to be suspicious of the other ethnic groups. This confidence in police waning from the Black and mixed ethnic backgrounds seems to be justifiable on that perspective.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things that I was reading about in terms of recommendations the other day, so this was advice given to women that have suffered sexual harassment, abuse, or rape. And a lot of the advice said to not go to the police first, but to go to charities first for advice. And that then they would be given the appropriate advice as to how to report to the police. And I thought, that's odd. Like, surely you would hope to have a police force that is well-trained enough on being able to deal with a case of rape, which are awfully common. The inability to deal with cases of sexual harassment, for example, is really telling. And it makes, you know, huge proportion of the population just not feel like they can go to the police because they're not going to find the expertise and the support and the, you know, belief that they need. It is tricky when you're trying to service a whole host of different people when we know that the police is mostly male and mostly white.
So I think just touching up on those two points very quickly, if I may, I think, yeah, what Amabit said, you know, we need to have a police that looks like the city that they police. A part of that is outreach. We need to attract more ethnic minority police officers to the police service. And we need to, once they are in what prominently might be an institution that doesn't really look like them, we need to make sure that we can support them through that process and make sure there's opportunities and there's mentoring opportunities for them. And I think the retention of ethnic minorities in the policing is also something that we need to work with, because, you know, it's all good and well getting someone to join the police, but then we need to kind of make sure that they're happy enough in the institution to stay. I mean, you know, from my own experience as an ethnic minority police officer, you know, I felt I was supported. I felt that, you know, my colleagues looked after me. At times I was actually exposed to racism, sometimes from hostile members of the public at times. You know, there had been times where I'd been called freshie on the beat when sort of policing some sort of public all the sort of situations. So, you know, that wasn't very nice, but I was supported. And I think, you know, it's all, we need to not forget the challenges that ethnic minority police officers might face in wider society, as well as the other way around of police and ethnic minorities. And just picking up on the issue of rape, I think reporting it, I mean, I think reporting rape can sometimes be quite a simple process. But I think where women struggle is the later stages of the criminal justice processes, you know, in courts, being cross-examined. It's embarrassing sometimes for them. You know, they have to bring out their whole sexual history and have in open court, you know, and sometimes that can be quite embarrassing. So I think especially with that, to instill confidence in victims of rape, we need to adopt a sort of a wholesome approach with all elements of the criminal justice system, obviously starting with the police, but making sure that women are supported throughout the whole process.
Yeah, you touched on a very good point, Milad. Again, coming from the North and from an ethnic minority community, females have, women, especially the Asian community, when they have been assaulted, especially on issues to do with rape, they are less likely to go to the police and they're more likely to go to perhaps their local mosque leader or imam or whatever. And they have their own internal judicial process, which the police may not be aware with, or they may be aware and they don't feel that they're justified in actually approaching this issue. And it may not actually be an issue within the police services. It may be something perhaps far earlier than that. Maybe something which could be addressed within schools.
Yeah, I think there's a conversation to be had, and maybe for a later podcast, on the PREVENT programme and how it's supposed to keep, it's in theory supposed to keep especially Muslim communities safe, but actually it just creates a culture of, frankly, ratting on each other.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's the amount of shame, and I don't know if my lads understands Punjabi, but there's a word for it, which is sharam, which is like absolute shame, despair. And say if someone's daughter has been raped, keep it within the family, don't tell anyone else, otherwise you're going to bring shame. This is not recorded in these ONS statistics. These will never be recorded. And because they're not recorded, they're less likely to be discussed, they're less likely to be brought in the House of Commons chambers.
We had discussed last week in the COVID racial inequalities podcast that even the ONS data on ethnicity in the UK is pretty dicey. A lot of it is based on the census data, which is old, inaccurate. A lot of people of mixed race might identify one way or another or neither. So sometimes when I look at some of these statistics, I'm like, well, can we trust them? Some of them are done per year, so that's better. But some are just not reported. So the same way that we know that in hospitals, deaths by ethnicity are not compulsory, I think some reporting within policing isn't compulsory by ethnicity. Now, we have to go on to Keir Starmer. As we mentioned at the beginning, a lot of these conversations have stemmed from a wider conversation on police brutality in the US specifically, but also it's really gone global. And so we are facing our own demons in the UK, what we have done with the Windrush generation, people that have been born on or grown up in the UK and grown old here and are now being deported, which is astonishing. We know that there's a big push for what the Black Lives Matter movement in the US have called defund the police, which is a wider call for a reduction in the completely overblown police budgets in the US, which sort of defend themselves with the law and order and also police union moniker, right? That we have to keep the communities safe and therefore you have to give us billions upon billions of dollars and hand grenades and military grade weapons, which is insane. The police in the US is much more violent, much more aggressive, much more well-armed, and the law defends them of almost any crime that they may want to commit. So that's quite different. So that's the context for the defund the police kind of slogan. Keir Starmer was asked about this on BBC Breakfast yesterday morning, and he called the Black Lives Matter movement a moment and sort of dismissed defund the police as something that was nonsensical, and he stood by his record as head of public prosecutions. So I just wanted to know your takes on the policy of it, because there's been a lot of politics on Twitter, but I think there's an important conversation to be had on policy.
Well, look, I mean, I think, you know, Keir quite rightly you know, did outline that the notion of defunding the police is not a solution, because that's not how you deal with issues. You don't defund it. You work to address it. And actually, you know, we need the police service. We all need the police service in one way or another to maintain law and order, help us when we need help, all of that sort of stuff. So I think defunding it just does not make sense. And I think, you know, he was referring to a moment which shocked the world, because that's, you know, that's where, you know, I think we all remember where we were when we started hearing the news reports. So I think, you know, I don't think he was in any way trying to degrade what happened, but he was referring to a moment which sparked worldwide sort of focus on the police and criticism of the police in the actions that they did, well, in America. But defunding it, I mean, it doesn't work. And reducing police funding or getting rid of it, it's not mutually exclusive to the services that you're not then providing. You can do both. You can fund the police properly, but then you can also fund these support services and community services which back policing up, which is what communities need. So I think we need to be really, really, really careful that it's all good and well, you know, having activism and you know, pushing for change, but we've got to make sure that we're not then disadvantaged by it. You know, we need to make sure that we support the police because we need them, but then we call for the same community services that have been taken away to be reinstated, because that's how we develop a harmonious relationship between the two.
Circling on to that Black Lives Matter, their agenda is to defund the police. I say, Secretary of the Young Economy and Finance Network, is that this doesn't really make much sense. And speaking as a BAME individual within the UK, the solution is not to defund the police service, but simply just making it more effective, getting more people of colour funded by the taxpayer.
And I think, yeah, I mean, in terms of like, and I think it goes back to what I said at the top, really, which was we govern this country, the police, you know, patrol on the basis of consent and not fear. And I think America and, you know, you go to a lot of other countries in Europe as well, and you go around and you see pretty much every police officer carrying at least a pistol, if not a machine gun. And again, I think that, so for example, obviously in America, the reason why they carry this, they have big, massive, like, look like tanks, some of these vehicles, they have all of this, is because of a thing called the 1033 program, which basically allows, mainly, it got particularly worse after the Iraq war ended in 2011, US forces pull out. You've got all this spare military gear going around, and basically the US Army sold them to police forces, state police forces and local police forces. Obama limited it, and then it was kind of stopped in 2015, but was then restarted by the Trump administration. But that's America. Again, there might be other countries who might want to look at it a different way. I think defunding the police in the UK is not the approach, because we have this unique approach to policing, which is on consent, and the fact that the vast majority, you know, we have special firearms teams, and they're the only ones that carry weapons. And okay, we can talk about cases being, you know, a sort of grey area here in terms of how that works. But in terms of an actual lethal firearm, I mean, potentially you could argue a taser is, but in terms of actually having a handgun and up in terms of, you know, sort of firepower, we don't have that in the UK.
Mm. There was an interesting note on how defunding the police was a wider kind of more social democratic case following the complete restructuring of the police forces in Sweden. So they completely dismantled what their police system and then rebuilt it as much more of a community support organization. Now, I agree with you, James. I think the nature of policing in the UK is very different. It doesn't mean that it is not at fault. Like I was reading, for example, there's been about 20 deaths per year in custody just of BAME people, citizens and refugees. And it's kind of unexplained and nobody seems to be held accountable for it. So even though, you know, we think, oh, well, you know, these people like servers and stuff, there's a lot of inequality. But yeah, it's not just that politically it's really hard to explain to defund the police to someone that isn't paying attention. You know, if an average voter heard the leader of the Labour Party saying, oh yeah, I like the idea of defunding the police, you know, it can be really scary unless it is understood. And also it's just not really applicable to the UK. Could he have mentioned other inequalities, like Amavir was mentioning, right? Like if you're a Black Caribbean man in the UK, you're 6 times more likely to be stopped and searched than if you're a white man. That's not right. And there's so much more that we need to be looking into. But the idea that systemically our police force is built on violence and animosity towards people is maybe just misunderstanding how the UK police force kind of works.
And actually, a lot of the things that we, of course, there's problems, and where there's problems, we need to deal with them. But the reason it's called the police service in the UK, you know, even the Metropolitan Police Service, is because they do deliver service to people. You know, say, for example, if someone goes missing, you know, that is a service that they provide. They go and find that person. If there is an accident, they respond to an accident and deal with those incidents. So there's a lot of non-controversial elements of policing, which actually, you know, they carry quite a lot of public cooperation. You know, if there's an accident, people will call the police because that's just what you do, because you trust that the police are going to come and deal with it properly and address it and, you know, all that sort of stuff. Or, you know, God forbid, if someone goes missing, you report it to the police because you have trust and confidence that they're going to go out there and find it. So I think a lot of what's happened, it's highlighted some really crucial areas of policing that we need to focus on improving. But we shouldn't then let that drag away all the good work that the police is doing to support and help communities. I think, you know, as I said, where the police are doing stuff right, we need to support them. Where there's criticism, we need to work with them and engage from a community level, go in, sit down with the police and find a way forward. Because as James rightly said, we're police by consent. We can contribute to the priorities of the police.
By police by consent, does it come from a social contract point of view? Because even if that was the case, again, me perhaps being an economist, but also being an econometrician as well, looking at the voting data, Black people don't want to vote. When you knock on doors, especially within my constituency, Neil Coyles, Bimsey, Noel Southwick, I don't want to vote, get out. Okay, next door, same thing again. In Stoke-on-Trent North as well, they feel more marginalised. And then because they are less trusting of the UK government, they're less likely to vote, they're less trusting of different institutions such as the police. And this goes back to this, one of the statistics that we mentioned before about them feeling less British, being less included within the local community. And that's something which we need to address. Carolina said a really good point, and I thought it hit the nail on the head. What else should Keir have said instead of saying, no, that's a silly idea? And having a chat with Toby, our data scientist, who launched an amazing event that Milad was part of last Friday, he said Keir couldn't have said anything else because he doesn't know. And that's a problem with the Labour Party. There's a huge chasm of the Labour Party associate themselves with the left, but people of ethnic minorities are left behind.
You're right that Starmer not having the statistics at the tip of his fingers, having an answer like, just simply as a policy colleague of mine has said, why not just say, well, the Tories have been defunding the police for the last decade, and that's not really been very good for the UK, right? Like that could have been a good retort. That in the UK, actually, police funding means community funding and all of the things that we want to see.
So I think in defence of Keir, as I think we all are, but you know, I think obviously at times in a lot of those interviews, you know, you can only say something as directly
Absolutely.
To the point that's been made. But I think actually it's quite an exciting time to have him as Labour leader because he comes in from a really strong background of working with the police and having a sort of an overview of the whole criminal justice system. So I think actually we're heading towards a really, really good positive direction for policing and the criminal justice system under his leadership. And I think we're going to come up with some really great policies. What I think is really important as well is that we need to have more engagement from the left into policing. We need to be having these discussions more often because the more that we understand and discuss it, the more we can contribute. If you sort of even look at neighbourhood watches, which are the sort of a very local, small platform where people get involved in it, you know, you get to see it in a lot more areas that aren't ethnically diverse. People are engaged in different ways. And just one of the points that I'm quite keen on is, and forgive me if it sounds a little bit controversial, but
go for it.
I think there is actually a role for policing in the planning system. And I'll tell you why. Because if you look at the science of crime, criminology, the environment that people live in at times does have an impact on the way that they're policed, the way that they contribute, the way that they correspond and communicate with each other. And I think what tends to happen, especially now that we're moving towards a more relaxed planning system, is that you've got neighbourhood police officers that have been working really hard in the local communities, and then all of a sudden they're getting these new developments coming up where they've got no say on how they're going to work, that they need to figure out how to police it. And sometimes some of these environments aren't very sort of cohesive with the community spirit. You know, you look at tower blocks, for example. It's very difficult to police tower blocks. It's very difficult to set up engagement groups in tower block and you know, watch over, sort of make sure that your neighbours are okay. If we actually allowed the police, again, I know a lot of police officers probably not want to get involved in the planning system, but it's a real positive thing because they can have an impact on how communities are built.
I actually think it's a great point to plug another Young Fabian event from last week. We did a book club about the book Municipal Dreams by John Borton about council housing. Now, about a million years ago, I graduated in architecture and worked in architecture for a little while. In the architectural handbook were recommendations on exactly this. How do you build communities where, for example, the kitchens all face each other, right? So, or the kitchens face the corridor, something that you see in council housing very often. These ideas of communities kind of getting to not watch each other, but just watch the kids in the street, have a sense of togetherness, have a sense that you're not designing a house in isolation, are very interesting and disappearing. That's one of the things that I noticed the most, that you would study them as a thing that was done, but not necessarily that you were doing in the present. A lot of things may have changed. I've not practiced architecture in a long time. Even tower blocks, there's ways of designing them. I think brutalism showed us kind of creativity in that way. I think the way that we plan, design our urban environments, our surroundings, and that kind of integration, I really agree with you that having someone like Keir, who, for example, on Armed Forces Day, revamped the Friends of the Armed Forces initiative in the Labour Party, very important to build a bridge, to talk to veterans. Really great. More conversation, more cross-pollination of ideas. You know, have the architects talk to the planners, talk to the law enforcement, because it needs to be a community thing. It needs to be a community building thing, otherwise it just doesn't hold up.
Yeah, just to add into that, I mean, obviously, like I say, you think of the estates that were built in the 60s. There was a lot of like sharp corners, and you know, a lot of like, you know, and that obviously means there could be somebody lurking behind there, and it becomes a hotspot for crime in that sense. So yeah, I just 100% agree with you that, you know, the way, and again, like if you're to regenerate a council estate today, all of that stuff will be taken into consideration. And like say, stuff like having the kitchens facing the same courtyard so the mums can keep it or the dads can keep an eye on the kids is a great way to do it. But also to kind of have like smoother edges, as it were, in the design will mean that, you know, the idea of somebody right now, well, there's like at the top street of a lighting stairwell could be a perfect thing, and street lighting, 100%. So yeah, and all of this, so, I mean, we're going off a little bit of a tangent, but in terms of, it's a good tangent, I think, because, you know, all of these issues are interlinked. And joined up government, anybody? Like, you know, the fact that everything does affect them. No, but again, it does, and it is important, because I was talking earlier about youth services, and you know, the fact that the youth club in the middle of the estate might have been closed down and the community centre has been run down and, you know, is not used anymore will just you know, exacerbate some of the issues we're seeing at the moment. So yeah, and you know, it is interesting how every different aspect of society, it seems, is interlinked into this, and sort of the police is such a key part of it as well. It, you know, it's integral, really.
I'm sure I'm not the only one who's thinking of the broken windows policies in, it was in New York and Chicago in the 90s, which said that a neighborhood that is kept generally clean, well-lit, tidy will in turn lead to less crime and so on. And there's a lot of really interesting research of looking at violence and crime spread as an epidemic, as a almost like a public health problem. We talked last week in the podcast about this idea of having health across all departments. And I think it's, you know, how does public health then intersect with law enforcement is really interesting. And how do we get like police and constables and officers and sort of like, you know, down the ranks to engage with these ideas?
Well, if I could just come back on that. I mean, obviously, you know, it's sort of one of the things that is quite important to this kind of joined up is, again, the kind of the public health approach, which, you know, is famously, I mentioned Glasgow at the start, being the first police force. They were also the first area to introduce a violence reduction unit and to adopt this kind of public health approach and to treat specifically violent crime as kind of as a health issue. And, you know, what are the things we can do to prevent it? And, you know, what, you know, as well as treatment, and, you know, it's treatment and prevention. So there's kind of two sides to it. And it's interesting how a number of other areas have taken that up in sort of the last two, 3 years. I mean, Glasgow have been doing it since the mid-noughties, I think. I've not got the specific date in my head, but again, it's that kind of, and they've seen a substantial drop in the amount of violent crime that has happened in the city, which has been, you know, and that's taken a long time. It's beyond your regular electoral cycle. So, you know, it needs commitment from politicians across parties to, you know, stick to it. And, you know, within a decade, hope, you know, 2 decades, you'll see that change happen. And so there's been one set up in London. Sadiq Khan, as Mayor of London, has set up a violence reduction unit, which again is sort of will take this sort of public health approach and look at the lessons learnt up in Glasgow and how they can be replicated in London, because you've had a particular spike in violent crime in the last few years, and you know that's predominantly like gang related. I you know, so there's incidences there that, you know, stuff like a long-term approach can take, but obviously it again needs that political bravery to say, right, this is something that might not be, you know, we might not reap the results of this until I'm out of office, but I'm going to do it anyway because it is 100% the right thing to do. And I know a number of other forces have set up violence reduction units as well in the last couple of years. So yeah, it's sort of treating it like a disease, like an illness, like a virus is one way to do it, which, you know, sort of come into fashion more recently. And hopefully, like I say, the benefits of that will pick up down the line in the years to come.
Mm. How we deal now with homelessness, for example, I really think will make such an impact on policing, on law enforcement, on some of these, just, you know, dealing with housing will have such an impact on some of the things that we see. Because if you're desperate, if you're in a vulnerable position because you don't know whether you'll have a roof over your head, then it just changes your entire outlook. So we'll close off. I will ask one question of you, which is, if you had one thing that you could recommend, kind of the Labour Party in general, not Keir Starmer, but like the Labour Party in general, one thing that we should be focusing on when it comes to policing and law enforcement.
The issue, I would say, is not the cure, it's about prevention. It's what I've been saying for many years. It's just bringing diversity within the national curriculum, making those within the BAME community feel as if they're part of the British story. White British and mixed white people are more likely to be educated and have better chances of success after school than those of their Black Caribbean and mixed ethnicity counterparts. And I think just having those initial skill sets and those qualifications and just feeling like they're part of that community would go a long way in preventing crime in the long term.
So we've actually started off calling for quite a lot of right things recently. One of the things that I think we need to be focusing on is really monitoring the government's action in response to the reports that have already been produced about policing and the criminal justice system as a whole. You know, the more that we can hold the government to account and sort of ask for this to be implemented. I mean, you know, David Lammy's report on the whole criminal justice system, it was one of the most wide-reaching ones across the criminal justice system, and it's still not been implemented. So we really need to follow up that good work that we're doing. But I think in terms of on a sort of institutional level, we really need to encourage, we need to listen to the police to see what their concerns are, what challenges they're facing. Because I feel that sometimes they are just a sort of, they do just have to take it from whichever government that comes in and just kind of try to cope, yet trying to deliver a really difficult job and you know, trying to protect communities under really challenging circumstances. So we've got to make sure they've got the resources to do their job. And then we need to sit down with communities and see what aspects, why they're losing confidence in policing and how we can actually improve that. And what do they want to see from their police service? And once we start getting those conversations, I think we'll be in a much better place.
So, yeah, just to build on both your points there, I think that, you know, for me, it's definitely about prevention and early intervention and trying to stop problem back to that method of having, you know, sort of PCSOs on the beat, sort of going and chatting to, you know, you might see a group of kids hanging about, but if the PCSOs go over and say, hey, kids, how's it going? You know, you kind of, they know who you are and you know who the troublemakers are and you know your patch and you know every street on it. And again, they're like, oh, we know, like, Bob, he's a good cop, etc. You know, he's all right, really. You know, and that kind of, if there is any problems that do occur, that, you know, oh, well, Bob's got our back. He knows what we're like. He knows that we're not like that. And that's kind of been missing from the last decade of policing, really. So that's the thing that's taken the forefront of the cuts. For me, I think the Labour Party should be looking at sort of looking at the preventative measures that we can do to try and reduce crime, and in particular the serious violent crime, which has gone up in recent years. And to me, the kind of the starting point for that would be looking at, you know, reintroducing more community policing.
That's fantastic, James. Thank you so much. Thank you, Amavir, Milad and James for the discussion today. It was really great. I am hoping that Keir will be listening and taking note, and his team. There will be many more conversations to come around this. We have got an LGBTQ plus special coming up, so it'll be great. We'll be talking about trans rights. We have got a conversation about higher education. So what's going to be the future of universities if people can't be attending in person, at least for the next year? So please watch out for that. Yeah, thank you for coming, and we'll see you next week.